يقولون سلام سلام ولا هنا سلام.
You're listening to Middle East Analysis, a podcast series from the Catholic Bishops' Conference of England and Wales. Hello and welcome to Middle East Analysis. And if you can detect a little jaunty bit in my voice there, that's because we haven't had one for over 2 months. Myself and our regular contributor, Dr. Harry Hagopian, were speculating it might have been 6 or 7 weeks, but no, we're actually beyond that. But we are back. We are back with Dr. Harry Hagopian. I'll remount your grand title, lawyer, political analyst, former Assistant General Secretary of the Middle East Council of Churches, and so on and so on. Actually, you've got too many hats. That's as many hats as you're getting today. But Harry has been in the region for the best part of 6 weeks and then on to a lecture tour in the US. So very busy guy, Harry.
Yes, indeed. And it's good to be back in this chair and in this studio, James. As you said, it's been pretty much 2 months. And if one day is a long time in politics, you can well imagine what 6-7 weeks would do for the Middle East and North Africa these days.
Absolutely. And so to crack on with that, let's start with your focal points. Give us 3 items of interest, things that we need to be focusing on in the Middle East, North Africa region.
Perhaps the 3 focal points that drew my attention and which probably have also drawn the attention of many of our listeners. The first one is what's happening in Syria. Clearly, with the Kofi Annan 6-point plan, is it going to work? Is it not going to work? Will the monitors that are being deployed in the country incrementally, as it were, till the end of the month, would they be able to hold the peace, hold the truce, lead the country out of violence? That's one thing that is a big question mark that everybody in the region and outside the region are asking. The second thing, I think, is Egypt, because there is so much happening in Egypt, and Egypt really does symbolize a lot within the Arab world, and we have all the tensions and confrontations between the military council on the one hand, parliament and the Muslim Brotherhood on the other. We have presidential elections coming up in a few weeks' time, and that is also grabbing a lot of airtime in Egypt and outside Egypt. There are issues to do with women and how women are treated in Egypt. So I would say that Egypt is the second clear focal point. And the third focal point for me, perhaps at the moment, surprisingly enough, because we haven't really spoken much about that over the past few podcasts, is that tiny statelet of Bahrain, where the Formula One race took place and which created in itself quite a lot of controversy. But at the moment, the controversy is focusing on political prisoners, on the confrontation between the monarchy, which is Sunni, and the large population and Al-Wifaq political party, who are largely Shi'i, and particularly the hunger strike of Abdul Hadi al-Khawaja, who is basically becoming an icon of the revolution in Bahrain. In a nutshell, those are the 3 points that immediately jump out at me, James, when you tell me, give me 3 thoughts.
We will move on into greater detail into some of those points. Mm-hmm. I'd like to start with Syria.
Okay.
And as you say, the ceasefire, which I'm doing my little inverted commas fingers here. Surely, Harry, for a ceasefire, you need to cease firing.
Good way of describing it. Indeed, one of the problems with the ceasefire is that there is no ceasefiring. And what I believe the Kofi Annan plan represents, and remember, Kofi Annan has been appointed not only as the envoy of the United Nations, but the joint envoy of the United Nations and the League of Arab States. His plan is, in a sense, the last chance saloon for Syria. There have been so many attempts, so many resolutions, so many meetings in order to try and find a solution to the Syrian problem. We have discussed this quite in detail in previous podcasts. There have been problems because, on the one hand, people want to get rid of Bashar al-Assad and the Syrian regime, but on the other hand, aren't sure what to replace it with because there is no clarity yet with the opposition, because there are so many dynamics intertwined in Syria in terms not only of the country itself, but also the region. So in a sense, Kofi Annan, as a very consummate diplomat and politician, was plucked out by all the members, the permanent members of the UN Security Council, to try and find a way, not of overthrowing or getting rid of Bashar al-Assad as previous attempts have tried, because that has clearly not succeeded yet, but to try and find a compromise where the opposition and the authorities, those with the regime and those against it, come together to dialogue and find a way forward.
Now, I called our last podcast on this subject Syria Solving the Unsolvable, so we should be in no doubt as to the scale of the task that Kofi Annan faces. But just tell us a little bit, what is the Annan plan?
Well, the Annan plan consists of various points. A lot of people are now focusing on the fact of how many monitors or observers would he be able to deploy through the United Nations in the country itself. That is one part of it, but there are other sides to it. For instance, all the heavy armaments of the regime, the Syrian army, regular army, they have to be withdrawn from all parts of Syria. Political prisoners and detainees will have to be released. Journalists and people should be allowed entry into the country, so that eventually there is enough confidence, between inverted commas again, for the different parties to sit together and talk and find a way out of this crisis that to date has cost roughly 11,000 to 12,000 lives. Now, that is a lot of lives in a country that is, in my opinion, critical to the future of the whole region. Now, what is happening is that even as we are trying now to see those observers or monitors deployed, the Syrian regime is playing cat and mouse games. It is not giving visas or issuing visas to all the monitors that the UN and the Arab League want to send in. So it's being picky as to who goes in and who doesn't. It is also continuing with the bombardment and the shelling of different parts of the country. So as a matter of fact, what you said is absolutely right. For a ceasefire to become a reality, you need to have ceasefiring, and that's not happening. Now, what worries me in all this is not only the regrettable amount of lives that have been lost, it's not the chaos of the country. There are parts of the country in Homs, in Idlib, in the northwest, in Daraa, which are war zones. That in itself is frightening. But what is equally frightening is as we go forward without any glimmer of getting this situation at least contained, if not resolved at the moment, the closer we are going to an all-out civil war. And we are already seeing that the opposition, which until now had relied almost entirely on peaceful demonstrations and protests, had, by virtue of the fact that they need to defend themselves against vicious attacks by a regular army that is so well armed, that it is turning into a bloodier and more armed confrontation. And that worries me enormously for Syria and for the neighbors of Syria.
You talk about the neighbors of Syria. If we pick up on Lebanon, mm-hmm. I don't know if this is the case because I only read reports, mm-hmm. but didn't the rebel fighters actually, for the first time, try and attack by sea somewhere near the Lebanese border?
They did. I mean, the interesting thing about it is there is so much of a fog of confusion at the moment that whenever we have explosions, whether in the rural areas surrounding Damascus, whether in Idlib in the northwest, whether in Homs, in Hama, in Daraa, in Syria itself, in Damascus itself, what happens is that immediately the regime and the television channels that support the regime immediately ascribe all those attacks to what they call terrorists. And of course, they're not terrorists, they're just protesters and demonstrators. And of course, the demonstrators then say, no, it's not us, it's the regime. So there is a little bit already of the beginning, not only of civil war, but of a loosening of any sort of accountability and monitoring that we can do to see what's happening. And that is, to me, worrying, because Syria is a mosaic of different ethnic communities, largely Sunni, but there are others as well. We need to make sure that the Druze, the Kurds, the Shia, the Alawites, the Christians, the Sunni, all together, if they start fighting even more, then this is not going to end well, and it bodes badly not only to Lebanon, which is the weak neighbor who's always the recipient or the repository of any violence or any machinations that are hatched up in Syria, but also don't forget Iraq, don't forget Turkey. Turkey has now tens of thousands of Syrian refugees in white camps across the border. There have been incursions and shellings by the Syrian army into Turkey. Now, Turkey is a NATO ally. Turkish authorities are not happy with what's happening in Syria. So, in a sense, we are really facing a critical condition. And this is why I call Kofi Annan's plan a last chance saloon, although for me, it only is a way of compromising between Russian and Chinese positions on the one hand, Western and Gulf positions on the other. Will he succeed? If I talk to many, many people, pundits, commentators, observers, people involved in the region itself, a lot of them would cast doubt on whether this one stands any greater chance than any other previous resolution. But then what other options do we have? That is the big question mark. Short of a military style Srebrenica or Kosovo or Libya kind of deal, I can't really see how we are going to be able to resolve this conundrum that we're all facing.
Well, we're going to have to let that question mark hang over us, but we'll pick it up again on our next podcast.
Mm-hmm.
I know Egypt was your second focal point, but I'd like to just take us into the statelet. I love that phrase. The statelet of Bahrain.
All right.
We have indeed had the Grand Prix.
It's the Emerald State.
The Emerald State. I've learned something new. The Grand Prix, it was somewhat controversial in a sense,
yes.
in that, you know, perhaps it should have been more of a moral position. All these questions as to whether it should have taken place. But it has shone the light back onto Bahrain.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what I'd like to pick up on is the human rights activist that is currently undergoing, I think, an 84-day hunger mm-hmm. strike in a military hospital
yep.
facility, Hawaja. Tell us a little bit about how the focus has obviously moved from a massive international, somewhat prestigious event now onto this man who's sort of, if you like, very emblematic of what's going on in Bahrain.
Well, if you remember, James, the Formula One race last year, it's an annual event, was cancelled. And people thought that this year, given the continuing tensions and the clashes within that statelet, that they would have been cancelled as well. Bernie Ecclestone decided, no, we're going to go ahead with it. And thankfully, it passed without any major tragedies. However, it is true that Bahrain has again come up as one of those countries that is being challenged by the so-called Arab Spring, which for all intents and purposes is no longer a spring. And in that sense, the political prisoners, one of them, their icon has become this Abdelhadi Khawaja, who is a man who has been on hunger strike for so long. His wife, his friends have been talking about how he's becoming weaker and weaker. And in a sense, if this man dies, then it's going to be even a worse situation than we are at the moment, because that is when the Shi'i population, because Bahrain is run by a monarchy that is Sunni Islam, but a large population that is Shi'i, and that is part of the tension on the island, this is when it is really going to explode. In that sense, I hope that those political prisoners will be released soon. Interestingly enough, a report, the Al-Basuni report, came up recently, which made serious recommendations about how to introduce reforms into the country. But as in many other parts of the Middle East and North Africa, you come up with reports which look very good on paper, but they're not actually implemented in practice. In that sense, I have heard, for instance, that a lot of the people who've been charged who are now on hunger strike, they are the same people who are going to be tried again. It might be one very aesthetic, cosmetic way for the regime to try and say, we're going to let them go free, but we can't just do it like that and look like we've buckled under. We go through the judicial process again and then say, hey, now you are free men and women. It's a difficult situation, but also the irony, James, is that A lot of people have pointed this out to me over and over again in the region. Look at Syria and look at Bahrain, two countries that are in the grips of tensions and clashes. They're not comparable. We've got about 10, 11, 12,000 dead in Syria, a lot of them from the opposition, but also admittedly from the regime, the army, versus Bahrain, which have had very fewer casualties. However, look at the Western reaction and the world reaction to it. We're all focused on Syria and what is happening in Syria, and we're calling for regime change, whereas in Bahrain, we're asking for exactly the opposite. How do we strengthen the regime, and why? Because the United States has its Fifth Fleet parked in Bahrain. Why? Because Bahrain is a very important bulwark against Iran and against Shiism spreading across the region into the Gulf. And of course, the two countries that wouldn't want to see that among all the Gulf Cooperation Council countries are Saudi Arabia primarily, and then the United Arab Emirates, Qatar, etc. Hence why there are even clashes now on small islands dotted around the United Arab Emirates as the Arab countries and Iran vie for control of those little spits of sand.
Well, Western interests, it's a very good point. I mean, even myself, I've transited by dropping off in Bahrain, and it, you know, you don't stop off in Syria, you don't stop off in many of these other countries. That there's a very sort of vested interest in a lot of the things that are happening in Bahrain.
There is, and I think what the Gulf countries are doing at the moment, they're all coming together to defend the Gulf region through the Gulf Cooperation Council and through the security cooperation between the Gulf countries and the United States in order to prevent any attack on it by Iran. And of course, for a lot of these people, and also for Western political thinking, unfortunately somehow flawed, the stability of countries in the Gulf means the uninterrupted flow of oil, means the possibility of having the fleet there, the possibility of having zones of influence. It's very, very interesting to see how the dynamics of the whole region are evolving into not only Sunni-Shi'i confrontations, but even within the Middle East and North Africa, we're no longer talking about a pan-Arab spring, but we're talking about different understandings of what those revolutions or uprisings mean to different people.
Well, hold it right where you are, Harry. I'm not letting you leave the studio. And everyone at home, please stay with us. That's the end of part one of Middle East Analysis. When we come back for part two, we're going to start by looking at Egypt. So stay with us on catholicnews.org.uk. We'll be back in a sec.